Trigger warning. This podcast contains descriptions of various abusive situations. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to the Preacher Boys Podcast, a podcast shedding light on decades of mental, physical, and sexual abuse within the independent fundamental Baptist movement. The testimonies shared on this podcast are told from the personal experience and perspective of the survivors. Not all legal outcomes are known or final. Any suspect is presumed innocent until proven guilty in the court of law. Now, here is your host, Eric Skwarzynski.
On June 2, 2023, the documentary series Shiny Happy People premiered on Amazon Prime. And while the series tagline promised to expose some Duggar family secrets, it ended up exposing a whole lot more, namely the work and philosophy of Bill Gothard, the creator of Institute in Basic Life Principles and the Advanced Training Institute. Gothard's curriculum was marketed as being extremely helpful for families to protect their children, but it ended up doing incredible harm. Today, a year after the premiere of the series on Amazon Prime, I'm sitting down with one of the Shiny Happy People cast members, Lindsay Williams, to talk about her entire life journey, from starting an IBLP as an 8-year-old to working alongside with Bill Gothard one-on-one at headquarters. And we even spend a good chunk of the end of our conversation talking about Lindsay Williams' life now, both as an advocate, but also as a successful makeup artist who's worked with brands like Vogue and GQ, and what it's like going from being a repressed homeschooler to working in the fast-paced world of beauty and fashion. It's a really incredible conversation. I had so much fun talking to Lindsay. We became instant friends, and I really know you're going to love her in this episode of the Preacher Boys podcast. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Lindsay Williams. Lindsay, thank you so much for joining me.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I've been wanting to talk to you for a while.
Yeah, same here. And I'm glad this finally happened. I reached out and you're like, I'm in Europe right now, so let's not do this yet, which is totally understandable. So I had to wait just a couple more weeks, but I'm really excited to be talking to you. First and foremost, how are you doing right now? How's life been in the wake of people seeing you on their TV screens talking about a chapter that's not so bright?
Right. That's a great way of phrasing it. I'm actually doing really well. I had done a lot of therapy leading up to the show, so I was pretty armored up to be able to handle the swath of, you know, outreach and people sharing their stories. And then, you know, I also have a presence on TikTok, so I just kind of kept up with that presence and tried to, in a way, be there for people because, you know, we were dropping a big bomb of awareness on a lot of kind of unsuspecting people, you know, where they weren't really sure that this would have anything to do with them. I think a lot of people thought it was kind of just a Duggar fest, like, oh, let's learn more about the Duggars. And then it's like, wait a minute, that information was in my church. I learned that growing up. So I wanted to be ready and prepared to support others as they realized, wait, this happened to me too in various ways. So it's felt daunting and overwhelming at a lot of times, but we're now in, you know, May. We're almost a year from when the documentary dropped, and I feel amazing. I'm so proud of what the documentary was able to accomplish.
Yeah. For, you know, you mentioned the TikTok presence and all of those things, and I similarly went into Let Us Pray kind of the same way, where it's like, okay, people already know me. Like, there's people that went in that were like, I've never shared publicly before, which I'm like, I can't imagine going from nothing to like, now I'm on Amazon Prime or HBO or, you know, any of these platforms. For you, in the wake of it, I know there was overwhelming support from people that go like, you know, me too, this was my experience as well. Was there an immense amount of like lashback that you experienced as well, where you were like, oh my God, I did not know that it was going to bring this wave of like newfound hate, you know? I'm sure you got samples of that.
The negativity.
Your other social platforms, but
I would say that that's actually, because I have a lot of anxiety, obviously see PTSD from all this upbringing, but I was most nervous about that. I assumed that the world would hate me for speaking up and sharing what I did. And I was shocked to find that like 98% of everyone reaching out and touching base with me were all positive. And the ones that are negative are actually, I mean, to be frank, they're cowards because it happens, especially in TikTok for me. I go live a lot because I like the personal interaction with people. And I get, shouldn't even say this online. Everybody's going to go, yeah, run over to her TikTok page. But I get reported constantly for hateful behavior and harassment and bullying, sharing my story with the world.
Yeah.
And so that gets a little bit frustrating, but that's the troll space. That's the world of being on social media. So to me, it's also like, well, who even knows if it's actual haters? It's just people being, you know, kerfufflers and making a problem with things. But there have been a few, as you may know, we have someone who's creating an anti-documentary.
Hey, that was my question for the end of the episode, but we'll jump right in.
Well, you just asked about the haters,
that's
man.
That's true. That is, if there's one hater, it's them. Like, that's
if there's
the
one,
hater.
It's this one. Yeah. But, you know, even that just has gained like zero traction.
Right.
I mean, the percentage of the quote, you know, hate fest of, oh, you know, people that were very prickled by the documentary are upset because they, well, I can't speak for them, but they are upset because they think that we're attacking Christianity as a whole and homeschooling as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And especially for me, when I watched that documentary and I lived that life, no one said all. Mm. Not once did anyone say all Christians and all homeschoolers, but that seems to be the ones that get prickled the most. That's their takeaway.
Right.
So, you know, we can't do anything about that. That's their own interpretation of it all. And they want to live in a life of defense and denial and not really open up their eyes to there are some that do get harmed by this. And there are also others who have flourished in these environments.
Yeah.
We're not saying that it's the worst thing that's ever happened to everybody. But you need to hear those who are saying, we are the canaries in the coal mine, letting you know that there is a lot of egregious stuff that happens in the shadows and behind closed doors in high patriarchal controlled, you know, families and systems like this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that gets lost so much where, you know, people go, oh, that wasn't my experience. And, you know, it's just funny because they can see enough to go, okay, well, your bad experience doesn't discredit my good experience, but they don't take another second to go, well, maybe my good experience doesn't discredit their really bad experience. You know, like there's a huge disconnect that I see all the time, even with the stories I cover, where people go, that pastor was really nice to me. And it's like, yeah, they typically are to a lot of people. That's how they stay there, you know? So for those of that, I mean, I think everybody might be loosely familiar with your story, but I want to go back to just the very beginning for those that aren't super familiar with you specifically. Your parents got involved when you were super young with IBLP, you know, and I listened on a little bit culty and you kind of said they were looking at it as a booster pack to Christianity. They were looking at it as this extra bubble wrap to wrap around you and protect you from the world in their mind. You know, what do you think the intent was going in? Do you think it was a pure thing of like, let's protect our kids? Do you think it was, let's add some extra layers of control so our kids can't do anything? Like, do you think it was ill intent, positive intent? How did it really start?
I think it was a crock pot scenario.
Hmm.
You know,
I
think
it
becomes this sort of like slow burn scenario where it's, you don't, no one just says like, hey, I'm going to get into a high control religion. I think that it gave them something that they clearly seemed to need. And all of this is speculation and assumption on my part because my parents have never been brave enough to divulge to me what drove them. They live in 100% defense of themselves. And I'm now no contact with them. But my perception from my experiences and other HI families that I know from growing up, I just think that because this is back in the 80s, I don't profess to even know my parents' high school experiences because they don't. They kept a lot of that from us. But it just seems like they fed into this rationale that the world was just inherently going to the dogs and just this place of pure evil. And in being Christians, they fed into that narrative. And then Bill comes along, and it wasn't just Bill. It was Bill. It was James Dobson. It's Billy Graham. It's like all these people that were popping up in the 80s. And I think they just felt like, hey, this guy has something that really makes sense to us. Because the one thing Bill does do well is lay out the problem and the precise solution. Mm-hmm. And if you're not thinking deeply enough, then you're just going to follow it.
Yeah.
And if you start to see peace in your life, calm in yourself, some type of production of what, you know, or reaping the benefits of what's been happening, then yeah, you're going to keep on following it. And he goes from the basic seminar to the advanced seminar. And then he built on that and said, hey, let's start a homeschooling program. Whatever reason he decided to do that for, I think financially, obviously, he had such a huge following. But it just, I've been reading through the wisdom booklets again for some projects. And he was so scarred. It is so triggering. And I'm like, am I re-scarring myself? But even reading through some of these wisdom booklets, I'm sitting here shocked that this is what my education was as an 8-year-old. I'm 46 now. My parents were even younger than I am at this point in time when they were homeschooling us with this material. And it is so blatantly not okay and not suited for children. So I have to keep deducing that they were so in that crock pot of safety and it just kept marinating for them that, like, this is the way we believe Bill. We believe him 100%. So anything he tells our children, anything from any of his systems, his organizations, his teachings, his training centers, his programs, send them to everything because we just 100% now trust him, you know, carte blanche.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you really just concisely explained the appeal of Bill Gothard, because I think even my reaction when I watch his content, when I see, you know, A Shiny Happy People, like everybody else in America saw when it came out, where it's like, who's this weird little guy with no wife and no kids? Like, how does he draw all these people to himself? And you think the same thing with Keith Raniere. You think the same thing with so many Baptist pastors in the independent fundamental Baptist world. You think of Joseph Smith. You look at all these people and you go, how did they get so much power? But then you go, it's all reaction. Like, it is reactionary to there's this threat, and the person identifying the threat, whether the threat exists or not, then has the power to go, here's the cure to this threat.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why I ask about your parents' motives in the beginning. I think about this all the time now as a parent, because I think I have some, there's parents that get in that want the control. There's parents that get in, and I think this is thousands of parents who got involved with IBLP that go, I want my kids safe, like all parents do. And have you seen Footloose? This is a very bizarre.
Okay, so, yeah.
So I just watched it like a week ago and it's fresh in my mind. And I told my wife, I said, there's two things in Footloose. One thing I love, one thing I don't love. The thing I love is that John Lithgow's character, as both a father and a pastor, it's very clear that his entire theology and worldview is centered around a reaction to a tragedy. It is an emotionally fueled thing that's justified with this logic.
Right.
And he brings the whole town around. I said, that's a very realistic view of how people become hyper fundamentalists. What I didn't find realistic is how quickly he folds at the end of the movie, where he's like, you guys are right. You know, I was like, that would never happen.
Give it about 10 years.
Right. But hey, you know what? The power of music. But it was one of those things, though, where I'm seeing in the Bill Gothard world, you know, there were so many that had that mindset where it's like, maybe they had a kid that had, you know, gone astray, quote unquote. Maybe they had experienced something themselves as teenagers. They didn't want their kids to repeat. And so they kind of just handed the keys to the childhood over to this guy that says, I'll make sure none of that stuff happens.
Right.
You mentioned, and so up to that point, that all sounds good on paper, but you mentioned that the curriculum was just not okay, especially as young as 8 years old. Now, somebody listening with no exposure to this might go, what does that mean? Can you give like one or two examples of just what not okay means in that context?
So these wisdom booklets, there are 54 of them. You're meant to go through one every 6 weeks, 4 to 6 weeks, depending on how the family works. It's up to you. So you're going to hit maybe 6 of them a year, maybe 8, just depending on how much your family goes through materials. So I was 8 years old when I went through the first 6 to 8 wisdom booklets, and we're learning, basic Greek. We're learning multiplication and division. We're learning about eye diseases. We're learning about things that, like, I'm 8. Let's just remind ourselves, I am 8. We're also going through theology, Christian theology. It's very meaty and so hyper-focused and spiritually bent to the education is very bent towards scripture, which I don't particularly want to say that that is the worst thing that could ever happen, but it's not accurate. It's just not accurate information because they are pulling from scripture and then they're just kind of pulling from their own thought processes and their own ideologies. It's not based in fact. So it's, I don't even know how else to go through it, but in my link tree on TikTok, my account is The Cult Chronicles. I actually have a link to all of the wisdom booklets because some blessed human being actually scanned in every single one of them. So if any is really curious, go, like, please go and take a look because they still exist. And when the homeschooling program shut down a couple of years ago, which I think a lot of the public pressure was forcing them to do so, they left the wisdom booklets available for home Bible studies. They basically took these wisdom booklets and now are selling them for just home discipleship Bible study classes. So my education, what I had to stand on going into the world, is now just a cute Bible study for Christians.
Hmm.
That's how warped this is.
Yeah.
That you would just flip it to a Bible study.
Yeah. Wasn't a robust education.
Mm-hmm. And it was very disjointed. It never built on itself. Right. It wasn't like I learned my ABCs and then words and nouns and verbs. And then here's how you write a sentence and a paragraph in a book. It's, oh, today's these really difficult words, but it's taken from this scripture verse. Now go find a thesaurus and a biblical lexicon and go.
Hmm.
And just like, again, I'm eight. What is all this?
Sure.
Yeah, very indoctrinating.
Do you remember time before? Like, how young were you when they joined?
Oh, yeah. I was eight.
So you were eight when you started.
Yeah. When I was getting homeschooled, they pulled me out of third grade. I was 8 years old in New Jersey. And then prior to that, they were going to the basic and advanced seminars.
Okay.
But I was in public school at that point when they were going to the seminars. Okay. But things were starting to change. Like I said in the documentary, just more and more of my freedoms started getting taken away.
Yeah.
I couldn't wear sleeveless shirts anymore. I couldn't wear my corduroy jeans that I loved so much. I had started to wear these insanely frilly dresses with puff sleeves. I felt like Anna Green Gables. And I'm just like, I like a puff sleeve, but this is getting ridiculous. You know, and then just my ability as I matured, that's when I started to feel it most. I think when you're a kid, you're not quite as aware. But when I became a teenager, started to develop as a young lady, it was, you could no longer talk to boys. You could no longer be competitive. You could no longer speak your mind. You had to really just, I really hate the thought of, like, back in those days, you know, it was so confining. Yeah. And I had to just imposter myself. And I'm very aware that that's exactly what I did. Because who I am now is who was always inside of me. This very sarcastic, mouthy girl who knows her mind. And I had to shove her back somewhere else and basically just pretend to be this facade of a submissive, demure Proverbs 31 woman.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I was curious was the, like, how much your parents were circling this before. Cause, like, again, you're just kind of going deeper into this system where it's like, okay, they're in the programs, we're doing our home devotions, we're going to this church, we're now pulled out of my school to homeschooled, to going to conferences, it seems like it's just, I mean, on the inside, it's got to feel like drowning because you're just going deeper and deeper, you know, but it's just this kind of step-by-step indoctrination. Mm-hmm. You've talked about on other shows and in the series, kind of the loss of personality. You just kind of alluded to that. You were very athletic, kind of a tomboy growing up, you're playing games, and all of a sudden, well, I can't play this sport because I can't wear the clothes required for that sport. You know, what are some other parts of your personality that had already begun developing by the time you're 8 years old that got silenced by, now I have to be part of this uniform group of silent, submissive women in this system?
That's actually a really great question.
Yes.
I I'm
always like, I'll find one along the way.
I gotta do one that someone hasn't asked her yet, which at this point is probably pretty hard. But I think that the outside form was the part that was the initial frustration of my, like, not being able to be who I was, mm-hmm. Because it annoyed me to have to wear a skirt. I had to act differently. I had to walk differently. I had to then be worried about all of the women and the people that would tattle on me if my shirt became unbuttoned or if, you know, a slit became unzipped or something. You know, it was all these privacy panels you'd have to be aware of on your body. And then I became very aware that my body was just a problem. And my image of myself started to just really go downhill. And it was like you had to present pretty on your head, your face, your skin, your hair, but then the rest of it underneath. I mean, yeah, when you stop being athletic and you stop really doing the fun things that keep your body moving, you just become frumpy, you know? And, you know, even as like when I was at headquarters, they're feeding you these types of foods that are just starches and carbs. And yet we're sitting in offices all day. And I started to gain a lot of weight. And in a way, I was like, well, maybe this isn't a bad thing because now I'm not going to be a stumbling block to people. Hmm. How wild that's, I don't know. It's like you're supposed to be in that prime where you're just like, yay, this is great. I feel so good about myself. And kind of in my mind, you peacock a little bit, you know, like, I feel so good about myself. It was just the bigger I could get the hair, the better, because then I was lauded over my hair. Like, oh, your hair looks amazing. But I think personality wise, when that starts to happen, you just withdraw from yourself because you're not really proud of what you see in the mirror. And you're really only living in your physical presentation to keep everyone around you happy. So I don't know that I was always aware of like what it was doing to my personality. It was just this constant hyper focus of making sure, well, is my skirt doing this? Is my tummy tucked in? Is my booty tucked under so that it doesn't sway out? I have a little bit of a tiny sway in my back. And so I always had my booty kind of stuck out. And then it was like, I realized I was tucking my pelvis under more so that I wouldn't have body shape. Hmm. And I think not realizing what that's all doing to your spirit. Yeah. You are, and that vivaciousness. And I don't know if I've said it much, but when I was sent down to Oklahoma City for getting in trouble for kissing my now husband at headquarters, I was writing in a journal at the time, which is a very dangerous thing to do in ATI because everybody always has eyes on things and you're always afraid that someone's going to end up reading your journal. But my writing became so tiny and so reduced. I was not writing on one line fully. I was using one line in the journal to write two lines of script. And it still to this day freaks me out when I look at it. I don't even know if I wrote that small. I mean, ants can read it. Just like in there, just as tiny as possible. And when I saw that 20 years later, I never really thought about it when I was doing it. And then I looked back and I'm just like, oh my God. Like, this is just a physical manifestation of how reduced I felt. Hmm. Couldn't have gotten any smaller at that point with how battered down I had become, with everyone from all sides judging me constantly, and I could never do anything right. And everything inside of me was screaming, like, I just wanted to get out and be free of it all. And yet, wasn't Jesus Christ and this system supposed to make you feel the freest? Hmm. It was so trapped. So trapped.
Yeah. Yeah. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Every single day, I'm dealing with extremely heavy topics like the ones I talk about on this show. And as much as I love hearing from others, it can be easy to neglect my own mental health. And that's why I'm so thankful for BetterHelp. You guys know I don't talk about products that I don't personally use myself. And to be honest, I was really skeptical stepping into BetterHelp for the very first time. I had never really done any formal therapy. And the idea of doing video therapy seemed really intimidating and scary, and I questioned whether it would actually be helpful. Well, now I'm almost a month into BetterHelp, and I have had such an amazing experience picking an incredible therapist that's understood and really fit my needs and my schedule has been an absolute game changer for me. And so I'm a really big fan of BetterHelp, and if you're thinking about starting therapy, it's a great place to give a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your ever-changing schedule. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. I actually switched therapists after my very first appointment, and the second person that I used became someone who I absolutely loved, and I can't imagine a better therapist for what I need. So never skip therapy day with BetterHelp. Just visit betterhelp.com/preacherboys to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/preacherboys. All right, let's get back to the show. It's interesting talking about this because, and my wife talks about all the time, like the feeling of there's so much focus on appearance, but there's such a fine line you have to walk where it's like, so I put out a question. I'm interviewing a sex educator on the show, and I put out a question, just said, how did purity culture affect your view of this? And usually when I'm doing an episode, I'll get like maybe 10 responses that are like, you know, sometimes three. Sometimes I'm like, hey, does anybody listen? Like, let's get some responses to this episode. Yeah. And, you know, I put it in there. Like a day later, I've got like 100 responses of just things. And there's so many similarities, but also a lot of unique experiences. Mm-hmm. But one that really stuck out? What in the world? That's like how Bill Gothard would say it.
Stuckered out.
A weird Canadian accent.
right.
sorry to all the Canadian listeners of the show. But one of the things that stuck out to me in the responses was one person said, I felt like something akin to, I felt like I was not supposed to focus on drawing attention to myself at all, but also I was supposed to be very slutty for my husband and desirable. And, you know, obviously in that context, referring to who people see at church versus who I'm supposed to be at home and all of the duty related to that kind of existence. But I think that also existed Sunday mornings. Like I always tell my wife, I'm like, you know, guys created this religion when modest is skirts and high heels and lots of makeup and hair done up. I was like, it's a very traditional view of like women's beauty. Mm-hmm. But then on the flip side, it's like you're expected to do all those things. But then it's also like you said, well, I can't have any shape, or I can't wear this that's too tight, or I can show this but not that. It's like it's a tightrope walk of like, yeah, I'm either a, you know, all the things you'd be labeled in the world, or I'm this like hyper. It's just a weird, I don't know. It's a very suffocating feeling hearing about. And as much as I hear these stories, I can't imagine being in that position, because all I had to do was wear a suit. That was relatively easy.
I wanted to be a man so bad, like, yeah. not specifically just, oh, you know, in that desire to change my gender. But I wish so badly that, like, if I had been born a man, or if I could just be seen as a man, it's so much easier for them.
Yeah.
Just put on a suit and go about your day. You get to wear khakis. You actually get to wear jeans.
Yeah.
And you get to go and do the things that you want to do. But women, no. And just like you said, there's this weird, the goalpost moves constantly for women. No. Like, yes, dress like a female, dress in the, like, this 50s, 60s housewife, but now make it 80s with the bigger hair, but don't get too big of your hair, you know? And if you're going to wear these pleated skirts, don't make sure that it doesn't cinch your waist too tight. But on other girls that have nicer figures, it's okay for it to be a little bit tighter, because, you know, that's so attractive. But if you're a little bit heavier, maybe you don't do that. Or if you have a bigger chest, you need to try to hide and reduce that. But if you have a smaller chest, maybe you can wear something a little bit lower, but don't make it too low, and blah, 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 blah. Like, it didn't matter. Like, whoever you were, the goalpost would always move for you. Hmm. So how do you stay in a consistent place of feeling even safe by the rules? I never, even when I followed the rules, I was still in trouble. There was still someone who was more fundy than me. There was still someone who was more moral than me. There was someone who was still more narcissistic and arrogant in the system, going, ha, I got her, you know. Yeah. Happened to me all the time. The girls at headquarters were so catty and would just constantly tell Bill on something else Lindsay did. And I'm just like, I can't live at all. And I woke up every day going, well, you're going to make another mistake today. Brace yourself.
Well, and you weren't really living in that environment. Like, it's a shell of you.
Yeah. It's existing in it.
Yeah. I'm curious. And I know again, I don't want to necessarily just go through chronologically because I want people to, many people are familiar with touch points in your story. But working at headquarters, like, because you went from growing up in it to eventually going and working at headquarters with Bill Gothard, who's
yes.
the mastermind behind this, not to give him too generous of an adjective, the mastermind behind this organization.
Yeah.
Talk to me about the kind of the outlook of, say, Bill and the staff versus the people there. Because like you said, it's a very competitive, catty environment where you have this powerful figure. The women there, and I've heard this from multiple people who've been in it, it was like, we want to impress Bill. Like, Bill is the man. We want to impress this figure that we grew up hearing from. Now mm-hmm. we've got the closest access you can possibly have. It's like, let's be the best we can be here. And then you have Bill, who's obviously, you know, I mean, in generous terms, a perverted, creepy old man who loves the affection of these women who want that attention.
Yeah.
Like, it just sounds like a recipe for a really bad situation. And obviously, in many cases, it was. So what was the environment like at HQ when you have someone so powerful drawing people and also leveraging that power in pretty nefarious ways?
It was strange for me, partly because the way that I came to headquarters was not by the normal route of going to headquarters. Most people that work there and the long-term staff tended to be people who followed a certain formula. They had gone through certain different programs. There was always these levels. You know, if you went through this seminar, the counseling seminar, and then go through a men's counseling seminar, and then go do this seminar, then you were higher up to be able to work at a training center as staff. And once you're staff, a lot of times you get paid if you're brought on because they see this godliness in you and you've accomplished all these things. But others would not. They would have to pay to be there. So they're paying to be a part of the ministry, which I also found always to be a little messed up. Like, wow. Really? They're like, if I hadn't finished the faith, knowledge, and virtue journals, which was a thing in homeschooling, if I hadn't finished those journals, then maybe I wasn't strong enough, but I still wanted to work there and be a part of the ministry, I would have to pay to be there.
That's
so
bizarre.
Yeah, it's messed up. So
what were people paying to go?
This was back in the 90s, so it was, I mean, you could pay, I think, anywhere from $150 to $300 a week.
Wow.
Yeah, per kid.
Okay. Oh, okay. So parents would pay for their, like, 17
to go. Oh, yeah. 15 to 25 to 35. I mean, if you weren't married, you could stay there forever
stay at
if
home
you wanted.
Daughters, yep. Basically. So it was
your
really...
Your stay-at-home daughters could go work outside the home only with Bill. Only for
And
them.
You pay for them to do that.
And you pay for them to do it, yes.
Maybe I wasn't being generous with the mastermind plan. He really figured out a really elaborate scam.
Oh, he's got it. He has it going on.
It was
on.
Really an extended summer camp. And people are there year round? Or was
oh,
it?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely year round. I mean, some of the bigger holidays, people would go home, but there would still be a bit of a staff at every training center. But most of the time, he had married couples on staff. And so a family would be living at one of the training centers that would be heading it up. So it would just be a skeleton crew during the holidays. But yeah, year round, it would be because most of the training centers and not so much headquarters, but most of the training centers had a lot of programs that were going on at any given time. There was a huge rotation of programs.
Sure. So it's almost like a substitution for college, but you're also leading. So you're kind of staffing it.
Yep. It, 100%. You got
system.
It.
So you said you didn't take that traditional route.
No. He found me at a seminar. I was assisting I was teaching, paying to teach at one of his seminars with my little brother. And he came into the breakfast room. We didn't even know Bill was staying at our hotel. And he came into the breakfast room, basically landed eyes on me and just fixated on me the entire breakfast. And then came over to me and asked if I would meet with him later after the evening seminar. And so that whole week, it was me meeting him in his office every night and having these very deep kind of spiritual father-like conversations. And it was very awkward and uncomfortable. He had an assistant there so that, you know, there's that the propriety, that there's nothing inappropriate going on between, you know, Gothard and this young lady. So we always had a guy in there, his assistant. But I think you've heard, and some have heard, like at one point he asked me if I was still a virgin. And I was 18 years old, but I've, even with my therapist, I told her, I'm like, I feel like I was 14 or 15 years old, because I don't even think virginity was ever spoken in my home. Like maybe one time. My purity was just simply something I knew I held, and that I could ruin at any time if a man came anywhere near me. And here we have Bill Gothard literally just asking me in front of this other young man, you know, I'm still a virgin. And anyway, long story short, he ends up asking me to come to headquarters directly, not go home and talk to your parents. He called up my parents late in the evening and was like, hey, would love for Lindsay to come to headquarters, and I think it'd be so great for her. And he just smooth operated this whole, facilitated this whole thing. And my parents like, oh, absolutely, Mr. Gothard. I mean, you're Mr. Gothard, you're next to God. So off I went with three other girls that he also picked up from the seminar. One was 13, the other was 16, and I was 18. And then we had someone who was 23. And we all drove to Indianapolis, took the counseling seminar so that I could have some level of, you know, having stepped up on one of the rungs in order to go on to headquarters. But yeah.
Were your parents proud of you for being picked? Like, did it earn some merit with them, or was it kind of just, don't screw this up?
No, actually, they never said that to me, but I never felt their full pride either. I think I was just out of their hair, to be quite frank. That's how I felt. I was because
free daycare, basically.
Yeah, yeah, because like, let's keep her busy. Because at even at 16, 17, I had a young man, he was 35 years old, who wanted to court me to marry me when I was 17. And that was really becoming a pressure in my life. And my parents were not... My mom was totally into it, you know, my dad was not, but I was getting to the point where I thought, home life is so awful, I'd rather just marry this guy and get out of here. And so I'm grateful in a very bizarre roundabout way that I was like, oh, Bill's presenting me something? Cool, let's go. You
took the bullet to dodge a cannonball, basically.
100%. Yeah, I was like, I don't know what's going to happen up there, but I'd rather that than this, because this is...
Yeah.
Crazy.
You end up in a documentary either way, likely, on either of those paths. But
probably not wrong.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad you avoided that.
Me too. But then Bill took advantage of my naivety, my innocence, my submission, all of the conditioning and indoctrination for me that I had been primed to be someone who could be groomed.
And I've talked to, like, Emily Anderson's been on the show. I've talked to a couple of people who've been connected to this world. When Bill is picking people, was there a, like, what was he picking based on? Do you think he was picking just because, I know he had like aesthetic things he liked about girls. I know that he would specifically express some of those things, like, oh, I love when girls look this way, which should have been a big red flag for every parent when it comes to sending your kid off. Do you think he was looking just at that, and then he's like, I'll figure out the rest later? Or do you think he was seeing someone like you sitting at breakfast going, she looks like she's moldable, she has a personality that seems like, what do you think he was looking for? Because I have to imagine he's being strategic in,
of course,
personality traits too.
Yeah. I mean, again, I can't profess to know what's in this man's mind, but through the copious amount of young ladies that came through headquarters, I even was a mentor to some of them, because I became a house mom at one point and had, I just call them all the broken birds. And he would just bring another broken bird back, and they'd be like, okay, she's going to be in your home. And I'm like, great. How do I warn her and help her navigate through this so that she doesn't end up with him the way I ended up with him? But I feel like he kind of had a formula, because it wasn't all blondes, all skinny, all blue eyes. It was their personality as well as their looks. And my opinion, he liked challenging girls, like girls that were more vivacious, people that were almost, you could tell that we were fighting our boundaries. And yet he knows how we are raised. he knows the way that, like, even we have this fire in us that's bursting to come out of us, but we're caged. So, you know, and not everybody.
He kind of raised you in a really weird way.
He knows what I know. Yeah. And what I don't know.
And you don't know more than what he taught you through your.
And when he hears, like, oh, when did your, you know, my family got in, not fully ground level, but we were a third year family, which is so funny to say now, but it was a point of pride. You know, we jumped on ATI like in the early days. We're some of the pioneers, cool. You know? Yeah. if you're a first or second year family, everyone was like, ooh, you know, like, oh, wow. So I'm always like, I'm a third year. But when I also said, you know, we started when I was 8. That's a lot of information for him to pick out, because this knew life before all of this. He went to school, he went to college, he had his experiences, whatever they may have been, but he knows the world to a degree, in my opinion. Now, back then, I was just like, he's the purest man, you know, that I know. like the closest to God. So you believe, you listen. And the longer I was around him, you know, the wool was pulled off my eyes and I saw him for who he really was. And that was also pretty crushing, because I started to become like really jaded about all of it. And so then that like inner turmoil that I had felt even more justified. And that was even harder. Because the level and the depth of impostering I had to do when I was at headquarters, and then the fakery that I had to put on for myself when I would go home to present myself as though I'm this, you know, I'm this great student that works at headquarters now. So of course I have the perfect attitude, and of course I have the perfect answers, and I'm always going to have the best responses to my parents. But I didn't. You know, I would get so frustrated and aggravated with everything. And I could feel my energy and my attitude changing. And I know that my parents felt it. But again, we weren't taught as a family to be open and to tell each other things. And I also felt that if they knew what Bill had done and was doing with me, that they would bring me home. And then I would also be shamed and blamed for everything. And I'm not an idiot. I don't want that on my head. So I'll just be here an imposter, and then I'll go to headquarters an imposter. And I heard a quote the other day that like really blew my mind, where they said, be careful of the mask you wear, that it will become your face. And I thought, it did for a while. You know, I got to a point where I was like, do I really believe all of this? Is it really working for me? Now Bill has me at headquarters. Did he bring me here? Because I really thought when he brought me to headquarters that it's because he saw God in me. Finally, someone saw how hard I was trying to be a good Christian. And he, of all people, he saw it across the breakfast room. But I look back on that now, and all he saw was a broken bird. He got the information he needed. He knew how much more broken I was when we had this week-long conversation. And I think that's how he realized where he could go with his grooming.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's a heartbreaking thing where, and again, it goes back to the crockpot thing, which I love how you said that, because there's so much good, bad, and ugly in these stories. And you know, religious indoctrination on its own is a completely, I mean, that's a whole nother topic. Like, we can go into the, when should kids be taught, you know, what does it mean to indoctrinate versus to give different paths and that sort of thing. But you know, growing up religious by itself, I don't think is necessarily a horrible thing. You know, there's a lot of actually evolutionary value to some of those things and traits, I think, if done in a healthy way. But it's a really sad thing to put yourself in the shoes of you as a young girl going, I believe that he has righteous intentions. And I believe that there is this God figure, and this person who's a representative of that figure sees that in me. To have that taken away, like someone listening to this who's jaded would say, well, at least the bubble bursts, because like none of that's real anyway. But it was real to you. And I think it's important to take a second to recognize, like, you're dealing with not only a violation from someone who's in a position of authority, it's like this is a violation of your worldview at that time. That, that's huge.
And you can tell no one. I have I have no one to discuss
he's
it with.
He's the top of the chain. Where do you go?
But no one's safe either. I can't talk to any of my quote girlfriends. You know, it was a point was made by a hater recently. Like, I can't believe for one second that these girls never talked to each other about what Bill was doing or about what was going on. And I'm like, then you fundamentally fail to understand what fear is.
Yeah.
Because there is absolutely no freaking way I would have told even my closest friends, only two males at headquarters knew what was going on with me and Bill. And even with them, I didn't share the depth of it. I made it sound like it happened one time because I didn't know even how they would react to it. And then just played it off and like, oh no, it's okay. I'm not, like, everything's fine. Just to hide, because it, again, I knew how it would fall back on me. But yeah, how, where do you go when you realize that everything you've been told to believe since you were eight is now just not really true? It doesn't hold, it has nothing for me. I just turned off inside and spiritually. I reading the Bible, I didn't even want to look at a Bible. I hated going to church. I hated sitting there and just, it just became this like torture in my soul. And yet I had to imposter because I knew I wouldn't survive any other option at that point.
So what's the first thing that gave you that kind of shattering moment where it's like, okay, Bill Gothard is not who I thought he was? And how quick was that roller coaster from something feels super off to like, oh, it clearly is really off? And like, what was the time frame of that? Was it like, I'm stuck in this for a couple months, a couple years, like, and, you know, to the point where it's like, okay, I absolutely can't be in this. Like, this is atrocious. Like, how slow or fast was that process?
The awareness was pretty fast. And I hate that for myself in a way, because I wish it had been a little bit slower of a burn. But maybe you just need to be smacked upside the head and it, you know, that jar helps. But even when I was in Atlanta, I found of course, it's flattering. I'm 18. No one pays attention to me except this 35-year-old dude back home. But like all of a sudden, this guy who is the ultimate in my life and my family that we surround ourselves in all of his teachings. At one point, he wanted me to meet him at the front of the auditorium after the seminar. And as I'm like walking through this facility trying to get to the big auditorium, and there's this escalator that I have to go up. And as I'm going up it, I'd already seen him two or three nights already. So this is like the fourth or fifth night. So we knew each other, you know, in a way, or had familiarity. And I'm coming up the escalator, not really looking up, and he had already come down like maybe a third of the way, and he ran back up the escalator. And it's just bizarre. And it was the first time where I'm like, well, he's acting like a kid, you know, like a teen boy. And he was just like, and laughing, and, you know, and he got up to the top and he was out of breath. And then I finally, I'm like, doo, 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 doo. Here comes a little pure 18-year-old. I mean, when you really think about it, he's in his 50s. Right. And he like grabbed my hand, and he was so encouraged to see me. That was his thing. Now he says I'm rejoicing, but he used to say, I'm so encouraged, Lindsay. And he had this like cadence about him. And I was like, that was freaking weird. And then also when he asked if I was a virgin, I felt like that was very strange. But then I was like, maybe that's just because you're trying to make sure that I'm pure for headquarters, because I know there's not as much oversight there as there is at the training centers. And I've always been aware that people have a little bit more freedom at headquarters than other places. But once we got to headquarters, he wasn't there the first week I got there. I'd been getting a lot of warnings from people, you know, well, be careful. I'm just like, be careful of what? What does be careful mean? And no one would ever tell me or expound on it. It was just like this really ominous warning. And sometimes under people's breath, well, you know, be careful. Then I started hearing like, oh, you're a Gothard girl. And I'm like, what? What is that? I've been living over here in Florida. I don't know what a Gothard girl is. I'm like, yeah, I'm here for Gothard.
Yeah. But, aren't we all?
Yeah. You know? Gothard boys, Gothard guys, Gothard girls. But anyway, that first time that we prayed, And he was very aware of a lot of things that were going on in my family, which again is the broken bird part where he like really dissected what's going on in your family and how's your relationships with your parents and da da da. And so we went deeper into that. And, you know, he found out like my father's not my birth father, but I'm adopted by him. And that's been since I was like 2 years old. And he very immediately was like, well, I'll be your father. And I'm like, oh, I already have one. So I don't, now I'm a little confused. But I was like, well, you know, whatever floats your boat, Bill. And then we have this prayer when he gets back into town. He's like, I really want to, let's like really supplicate with the Lord about your family and these trials that they're going through. And we go over to this velvet couch and we like, I thought we were just going to sit down. So I like turn around to sit and he's like, oh, no, no, we're going to kneel. And I'm like, I hate kneeling to pray. I always have, even as a kid, like, I don't, my bony knees, I don't like it. And I'm like, oh, really? We're going to kneel? And so like, he's on one cushion of the couch and I'm on the other. It was just a two cushion couch. It's a pretty small thing, but I'm like, okay, I'm over here and you're over there. And I go to close my eyes and all of a sudden I feel his hand and he had slunked his body over next to mine. And I'm like, why is he so close? And again, I'm coming from purity culture. I don't get touched. I don't touch others. And all of a sudden this man of God is like slunk. And he's like caressing my hand as he's praying. And I can't even think. All I can focus on is the physicality of what is this? And my heart is racing and even telling it gets me like, so like, but, he starts like leaning his head into mine and like kind of nuzzling it. And then it's his like shoulder and his hip and his thigh and his knee and all the way down to our shoes. And then he starts clacking his shoe against mine. And I'll never forget the sensory of it. Like, why are you clump, 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 clumping your foot against mine in the similarity to you rubbing your hand against your thumb on my hand? And I don't know if I was shaking. I have no clue. I think I was probably pretty stoic, just knowing me at the time, like the impersonating and just like impostering. And all of a sudden he nuzzles his head towards me again. And I'm like, what is this? And then he's like, it's your turn. He whispers in my ear. And I'm just like, ooh, my turn to what? And I literally considered that what he meant was for me to then do the same to him, to rub his hand and to push my head into him and my body up against his profile. And then all of a sudden I was like, oh, no, duh, pray. Like, it's your turn to pray. And so I just had to like turn all of that off and try to say words out of my mouth. And I remember my mouth being so dry and just like, I don't even know what I'm supposed to utter. And I can't remember. The funny thing is I remember all of the physicality of that. Don't know what I said at all. I was like, word, 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 numbers, is this working? You know? And then, you know, as soon as I said amen, he was like, amen. And he squeezed my hand really tight. And I was up off that couch like a jackrabbit. I was just like, poo-hoo. And walk over and get my tote bag and good night, Mr. Gothard, and see you tomorrow. And I just, out I went. I didn't ask for dismissal or anything. I was out. Hmm. And that scenario played for about 4 to 6 months.
Wow.
Consistently 3 to 4 nights a week. Yeah. And I just had to steel myself because I knew that this is what we were gonna do. And my ability to believe in him, my ability to trust that anything he said held any value was just down to zero. And I stayed at headquarters for almost 3 full years.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And what was the final straw for you leaving? What was the reason you broke away from that environment?
Well, it wasn't by choice. I actually got in trouble for kissing a guy. And I think, honestly, I think at that point, I had found this like wonderful human being who is now my husband of almost 24 years now. So I picked wisely. He chose me though, really. But I really fell hard for him. And yet at headquarters with purity culture and everything that we're raised with, like that type of fraternization is not okay.
Yeah.
Like boys and girls do not intermingle unless you're playing handbells or singing in a choir, and then that's it. And so we were discovered over a phone call. Someone overheard a phone call that we had where we basically said, we shouldn't have kissed each other. And it was great and all, thank you so much, but like, let's never do that again while we're here. And someone else overheard the conversation and confronted us about it and said, you have to go and tell Bill or I'll tell him in 24 hours. So we were forced to have to like confess our horrific sin. And the next day or two, my husband was gone. He was sent home. I stayed at headquarters for like another 3 months. And even in that, I'm just like, I don't understand. Like, I should not be here. But Bill took it as an opportunity to pray for my moral compass and blah, blah, blah. You know, it just, he always found another reason to come and have me pray with him. Yeah. And finally, it was actually not me. It was the board of directors. I hate laughing, but it cracks me up. Like, he sat me down after a meeting one day and he was like, well, Lindsay, the board of directors is no longer allowing me to keep you at headquarters. Yeah. And I was like, wait, what? Like, what does the board of directors have to do with anything? And apparently they were just like, she's got to go. Like, bye-bye. So I was like, well, you know, I understand. You know, I guess I'll go home. I knew my clock was ticking to go. Sure. But I was like, well, I guess I'll go back home now. And he's like, well, actually, I already talked to your father. We're sending you to Oklahoma next week. And I'm like, whoa, wait, what? So I was actually shipped to Oklahoma training.
And you're like 24.
21 years old.
Or yeah, 21.
21 years old. And I was sent, like, it was against my will. I did not want to go there. I loathed the training centers. They are not okay. These places are so bad. And I was like, great. And I was treated like I had the scarlet letter on my dress when I was there. I have a few people, you know who you are, that were like absolute saviors to me and just like made me feel like a human and at least seen. But for 5 months, I was in pure hell, doing monotonous chores and all this kind of stuff. And it was awful. But that was the tipping point, truly, where I'm like, I have to find a way out of here because I'm never coming back to any of this again. And I gave the testimony of a lifetime. Like, they would have these like, oh, you know, all of the like little baddies that would get sent to these training centers. You know, at some point you just have the stirring of the spirit that you've, you know, oh, I've seen the error of my ways and the Lord has really shown me and I'm so impressed upon, you know, my soul that I need to change. And so I got up my Bible verses and I was like, you know what? I really want to give a testimony. Like, I turned it around for a few weeks and I'm like, oh, look at my precious angelic self. And oh, everything is so shiny, happy people again. And it worked. And I was like, I need to go home for the holidays and be with my family. And I packed everything up. I shipped it all home. I was like, I'm never coming back here. And yeah. I did not. And Bill called me a couple of times after that, wanting me to be involved in the ministry. And I was just like, well, the only place I would go is headquarters. Oh, well, that's unfortunately not possible. You know, the board. I'm like, well, all right, well, I won't be involved in your ministry.
I'm curious from the Bill perspective with the board of directors. It's an interesting thing. Because again, like, there's what happens and there's like, which obviously for years you've been going, well, this is why these things happen. Do you think the board of director, okay, in my mind, when you said that story, there's like three things in my head that are possibles. Yeah. It's like board of directors kind of know Bill has a problem and they realize like, okay, he's getting too close to this one. Let's move them. The other one is you've gotten too old for Bill. Bill needs to just move you and move someone else into this environment. The other option is the one on face value, which is, hey, you don't really represent our values. Let's ship you somewhere else, which seems like the least likely option to me in this environment. What do you think now was the reason that you were treated with such like, because obviously he liked girls to be broken. And it seems like for a couple months, he used you getting in trouble as extra leverage to have more time with you. Yeah. So it seems like a weird shift to then go, well, now you're too broken to be here. Like, what do you think the real reason is that you got kind of labeled as like not safe for headquarters?
I love it. Not safe for work. I think that the latter option that you just said about the board, that was their excuse. Their excuse being, well, she's really kind of morally flawed now. The Kiss was not the first guy that got sent home because of me. He was the third one that got sent home because of me. I was a troublemaker without really trying, but here we are. Yeah. But I think the board was just like, she's toxic. Get her out of here. But also, yeah.
She's destroying our young men.
Right.
One by one.
All the good ones are
breaking hearts, taking names.
We don't send her home, but we definitely send all the boys home because they know of Bill Gothard's proclivities to younger, beautiful, vivacious women. And so I think it's twofold, but they will use the excuse of, well, you know, she's just like, she's causing a lot of trouble. She's broken a lot of rules. She's tainted right now doing, you know, these impure things. And so we just need her to leave. Hmm. However, I think they've always been aware. I refuse to believe that the board was not aware of Bill's issues. Like it's obvious. But they didn't ever act on that. They would send us girls home. They would, you know what I mean? It's always like, well, remove the women, remove the girl, remove it. You know, we're the problem. We always have been. Even says in scriptures, you know, we're the ones that are the wiles of the devil. Da, da, da. So I think it's twofold with that. And I think it's a shame that the board didn't have a backbone and never has had a backbone to really put it to Bill.
Do you think that the people around Bill? And again, I know you can't really know what people really thought, mm-hmm. you know, and so it's speculation. But do you think the people around Bill chalked it up as he's kind of a strange older man? Because I think culturally, that's a big issue. Yeah. And I want to make sure I specify, I don't think this is okay.
Right.
But I think we tend to forgive old men as like, well, they're creepy old men, you know, like, and especially now that, you know, now as a parent, like we tend to excuse guys in cafes being like, look at that pretty young girl. You know, like that kind of mentality just gets excused over and over and over again. And
he doesn't, I will say, like, he doesn't read as creepy in person.
Right.
Like, because everybody knows this narrative now and they just see him on a blue
screen retroactively
between
creepy.
Two ferns. You know what I mean? It's like,
sure.
He looks weird because it's now not the 80s and the 90s. Right. But when we were back in that time, he's kind of a little bit rigid, you know, in his body movements. Which to me always came across as him being a little bit more reserved. Mm-hmm. And so it didn't seem like he was going to be some type of aggressor. He never seemed to be, I can't profess for anyone else, but to be like a very aggressive individual when he was alone with women. But to me, he had this very unassuming type of personality. You know, it was charming in its own way. And he had that weird lilt to his voice. But, you know, it was super unique to who he was. So I think a lot of people were lulled into that false sense of security because of his mannerisms and his behavior.
Hmm. So he just seemed harmless.
Yeah, he does not come across as a creepy old man. You know, he's not like kissing babies on the head. He's not doing these like weird things. It's really when I will also profess to say that, or I will also say that I was at headquarters from 96 to 99. Mm-hmm. It seems when I left in 99 from all of this, it seems that in the next 10 to 15 years, he did become very creepy. And the more, when I started reading Recovering Grace and even some of the things that Ginger Duggar said in her book about the Gothard girls, which was a pretty triggering, chapter in her book for me. But she, you know, she even mentions like how he always seemed to be talking to really pretty girls. Yeah. And it's, I think that's still incredibly telling because when was he really talking to young men? Like if he wanted to tout this purity culture and this high moral compass, why in the world are you always surrounding yourself with the females? Where are the broken man birds? You know, like where are they? Where are you trying to heal? If it's equal and you're not doing anything weird, then why are you not equally doing men's prayer sessions and counseling sessions and women's counseling sessions? It was not even close.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's where I'm getting as like the physical contact, was that just chalked up as, well, obviously he doesn't mean anything by it because he's so innocent.
Yeah.
Like,
He hasn't had a wife. He doesn't date. He's not doing anything.
He's not even thinking about that.
Right. Like he, we know his materials. We know how the men are supposed to think from the men's seminars. So he is the most pure-minded man there is out there. So why in the world would he ever consider, you know, doing anything? There's a picture that I have as my avatar on, I think it's Instagram. It's really small, but it's him and I together, and we're in Romania. And even in that picture, his hand is on my waist. It's around my back and on my waist. And even that, like, he slipped it in as we were standing there taking the picture. And I was like, whoa, like, what are you doing? Like, if any other male had done that to me, out. They would have been out immediately. But he would find little ways to do stuff like that. And it was always accepted.
Yeah,
right. They just turn a blind eye. Why? Because he's Bill. Because he's all powerful, and you know we can't throw out the baby with the bathwater. You know, we got to keep Bill with everything. Yeah. Because then what happens if that crumbles? What happens if that is revealed about him? You know, what happens to all of the things he's ever said? Does it get discredited? I always wondered that. What would happen when all of this came out? And what they've done is they've whitewashed him from the material. They still exist. IBLP still exists. They're rebranding themselves as the Home Discipleship Network. So be aware, everybody. That is an IBLP program. It's an IBLP program. And they have other programs as well. And he has his own embassy university, which is, if you would like a chuckle, go look at university. Embassy University. But they have taken his name off of everything. And even in the seminars that they do now, because they do like, I think every 6 months or so, they do another seminar. And they basically just do not state his name at all in any of it. So it's just, he just doesn't get credit anymore.
Sure.
But all of his materials are still being sold and used.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really helpful perspective, because I think it's always good to know. Like, why? Like, and I think him presenting himself as being this like untouchable kind of saint figure who's created this amazing curriculum really gives him a lot of leeway within that world. So you left like pre-2000 from all of this, which is early, because the heyday, I mean, it continued to keep thriving and ramping up. And you look at, you mentioned the Duggars, who really, I mean, if anything could have helped the PR for a while, that was them. I'm curious from your perspective, as someone who left that world and was on your own healing journey for years up until kind of that time frame, when you see 19 Kids and Counting get a stranglehold over American culture, like, was part of you, I mean, first of all, that had to be like a kind of
I hated it.
It had to be a weird, like, traumatizing thing to see it, like, put up.
It made me so sick.
I mean, because that show started, what, 2000?
I don't even know, because honestly, I've never seen an entire episode. I had a friend that, and I will say, when I left, I wouldn't call it a healing journey at that point. It was more just, I'm no longer over there. And now I'm just going to flounder and flop like a carp trying to figure out the rest of my
floundering
life.
Floundering journey up
just
to that point.
Just the flippy floppy. Yeah, like, what is this? And I did so many crazy things. And I was just like, I don't know who I am or what I am anymore. I'm just going to try to exist. But when one of my friends, like, and I would never tell people, oh, I was raised in a cult. Or I was raised in this.
You just kind of were like,
I was
that's
a Christian,
not me anymore.
Or I am a Christian, but I don't tell people. Yeah, it was like, I went to church, I think, for maybe another year after we got married. And I finally told my husband, can't do this anymore. I do not even want to walk into a church building. And still to this day, I can go to cathedrals in Europe because they're so beautiful, but do not take me into an actual like American church. It is just not going to happen. I get so much panic. I was on a photo shoot recently working with a girlfriend of mine, and I started shaking. I was like, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to go in there. I can't. Like the building itself is no. But I actually had a friend who kind of knew a little bit, had kind of picked at me and tried to figure some stuff out. And they're like, hey, I know you said you used to wear a lot of skirts as a kid and stuff like that, but there's this show. Have you ever seen it? And It's called like, you know, 15 or 16 kids and counting or whatever. And I was like, well, I'll go check it out. And I turned it on and I don't think I watched more than 2 minutes of it. I remember seeing them at the long table with the wisdom booklets and the skirts and everything. And the way that Michelle Duggar talked. And I was like, nope, nope. I even said it in the documentary. I'm like, nope, nope, nope. I lived this. I do not need to watch 1 second of this. And even like people will send me clips and stuff of the Duggars and these like wild things. And I'm like, I don't want to know. I know. Yeah. I'm like, just put Lindsay in there. And I it's the same for all of us, Lindsay, Chad, Heather, like we all experience that same lifestyle. Yeah. I was actually really shocked when I saw it that they would even have been given permission to go on TV.
Yeah.
And that's where I started realizing like, whoa, my ATI is not this ATI. Like this homeschooling thing and Bill Gothard, they've gone off the rails. When I was in it in the 80s and 90s was when they had the highest attendance. In 98 and 99, they started to tick down in enrollment for the homeschooling program. And that became this huge like red alert. We need to start like doing a lot more to promote it and talk to these families so that they either don't leave or we can have them help recruit other families. And what can we do to aid that? When I saw the Duggars, I forget what it was, but there was something where I saw the new seminar. Oh, I know my in-laws are still in the program. And so they go to the yearly homeschooling seminars. And when I saw a picture of the auditorium that they now use, it's not a stadium like we had back when we were in it in the 90s at the Thompson Bowling Arena in Knoxville. They were now just like in a really big space, you know, and it was not nearly the amount of people. And I was like, whoa, they've reduced by at least over half in their enrollment. And of course, it made me feel good. I'm like, good, I'm glad to hear and see that it's dwindling. And as of even a few weeks ago, they had another one of their, you know, big Sandy seminars, and it is so small. Like it has really, really dwindled. We're down to the point where we're with like the fringe ones that are still like trying to hang on with their little claws into this fundamentalism thing.
Yeah. Yeah. My wife grew up Southern Baptist and got really big into the Duggars. Like, so I met her in high school. And I too was in high school, just to make clear.
Okay.
not a hardcore fundamentalist. I always like to say that now because when you grew up IFB and you say you meet your wife in high school, you have to clarify
that you were 25. Right. You weren't 25.
I was her youth pastor. I was the assistant coach of the girls' basketball team. Ooh. And man, she caught my eye.
Right.
But anyway, no. So I was in like 11th grade when she came in. And so our school had gotten a lot looser at that point. It was still very strict. There was major, major issues. But it wasn't like, I feel like I grew up in different phases of fundamental where it's like, we were super strict and this, and then like it loosened up where it's like, you don't have to wear a tie on Wednesday, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right. Yippee.
And so, but when my wife came in, it was in that stage and she started watching the Duggars and like everybody in America, like was drawn to this picturesque family. And I remember her putting it on. And even when I was still in it, I just said, what's the appeal of this? I was like, I know photocopies of these people. Like, I'm not going to watch a show that's just my life. Like, it's just literally.
It's a freak show. It's TLC. Yeah, it's like everything else, you know, my Strange Addiction, all these types of things that they were airing at the time, you know, Toddlers and Tiaras, I think was on their show. And then you've got 19 kids, like, well, not at the start, but every year she was popping another one. And you're just like, how? Like women around the world are going, her uterus, you know, like how?
And I think that's kind of part of the draw. I'm glad you mentioned Toddlers and Tiaras because I was thinking about the time frame in reality TV where it's like going back to that reactionary. I've never put these together, but I think you're seeing the it's funny because it's really just two shades of abused, traumatized kids.
Exactly.
But you have Toddlers and Tiaras, which on TLC was presented as there's these really you know, really messed up moms and really bratty kids, you know, which again, I think we could look back and say that behavior was not the kid's fault. Exactly. But then you look at that and then you have this picture and then you have this picturesque Leave It to Beaver, very 1950s Christian family.
Yep.
And if you put those two side by side, that one looks pretty damn good compared to the circus of Toddlers and Tiaras and Dance Moms and all these different kind of shows. Yeah. And so you have, again, that reactionary drawing people in. They become a huge spokesperson for IBLP. Like, all of this kind of environment really starts thriving. I know we're skipping years of work and things that happen, but I'm curious, in the midst of all this, so somewhere between 2000 to 2023, where you're going on TV and sharing this story,
right,
you're getting involved in this industry of modeling, fashion, makeup. That's part of your story that hasn't really been touched on anywhere else that I've seen.
Yeah.
But it's something where I literally found out, because when I scheduled you, your email had this URL, and I was like, do research. And I was like, oh my God, you've got this crazy career where you're working with incredible celebrities and doing makeup and fashion and like an incredible work, by the way. I was going through the website, like looking through. I was like, where are you today? I've got a pimple right here that's going to be here through this whole interview. But I'm going through and I'm thinking, this had to be a trip navigating this industry that is about beauty, fashion, drawing attention in many ways. Like, was that a journey of like navigating this repressed homeschooled, like, we don't do any of this, to now I'm working in this industry that is all about this? You know, I think of Alice Gretch, I just interviewed, who talks about going from super conservative, you know, environment to now modeling. It's right. Like, that's a big jump, like seeing pictures and going, is that me? You know?
Right.
So what was that like? I'm just curious about that experience, and I haven't heard anyone else ask about it.
You haven't. And I've been waiting for that moment when someone would ask, because it is so multifaceted. And I, of course, couldn't see it at the time, but when I look back now, I'm just like, wow. Like, I had some balls on me to just be like, you know what? Let's go try other abuse.
Let's go try the opposite of this thing.
Sweet. Yeah. And I have nothing. I have no context. I have no television background. I have no modern pop culture. Like, nothing. I mean, yeah, I know who Marilyn Monroe is, but I don't know. Like, I was in a barrel in the 80s, the 90s, and the early 2000s. What the heck did I know about anything? I didn't even know where to start researching, but I was so into just how pretty things were on the outside. You know, when I remember, it was actually when I got married, I started buying magazines. Because before that, like, the only magazines you could really have was like Better Homes and Gardens or this one called Victoria magazine. Oh my God. Ugh. It's not my thing, but I impostered and it was for a while. But even then, when you would have the magazines, if there was an ad with a scantily clad woman, you'd rip it out, because God forbid my brothers see, you know, a woman in shorts. And so to have all these bridal magazines and just like, oh my goodness, like, oh, this is what makeup really is. And look at these beautiful dresses and like, ah. And so then the modeling thing kind of came along because I had, one of the photographers I worked with, or the photographer that shot my wedding, submitted some of the images to a magazine, and several of them got printed like in the back of the magazine. It was nothing like some huge editorial spread, but it was just like a few little pictures. And I remember feeling, oh my goodness, I'm in a magazine. It was kind of like, who is Sully? In not Sully, but Wachowski in Monsters, Inc.
I'm on TV.
I'm on the cover of a magazine. I was like, no, I'm just like these tiny little pictures. But anyway, I had a few friends that at the time that were just like, oh, you should, like, maybe you could model or something. But of course, it's still like very Christian-y, right? And I'm like, how can you be a model and then but be a Christian? Like, I don't see how that's gonna work. But I went online. I was like, I want to model. I just started looking
like
into
WikiHow.
It. Like, yeah, exactly. But I found myself, I went to a modeling school, which now I would never advise anyone to ever do. But I went to a modeling school, which actually was not bad for me, because I needed a soft, rise in understanding the world. And so, you know, my teacher was pretty gruff when it came to runway walking and all this kind of stuff, but she still was, I think she saw something in me where like I was probably a broken bird. She was like, this girl feels like she's been living in a bunker. Like maybe we need to help her out. But I grew confidence in that just period. Just it helped me gain confidence. And then from doing some of the modeling stuff, like I started modeling in lingerie and in swimsuits, and it was not making people I knew very happy, especially the ones from headquarters and all these other people that were my fundy friends. And I had to make a choice. I remember the day I had to make the decision. Do I say screw it to them and find my way, or do I continue to kowtow to this belief system and just let all of that go? And I realized in that moment that I did not want to live a life of regret. And I was in control moving forward of my choices. And if I worried about regretting something that I would or would not do, and I needed to do it within reason, obviously. But I was just like, I'm not going to regret trying to model. Mm-hmm. And will I regret leaving all of these people? At that point, no. Like I was so tired. I mean, you're boring. You're tired. You're not joyful. You're not interesting. You're overbearing. You're just so oppressive. And I don't like it. And I love this freedom of being on set and listening to rock and roll. And everyone's creative and they're just free flowing. And no one's cruel up until that point. People weren't really cruel. But once that tripped me into becoming a makeup artist, because I was doing makeup for myself in a small town. And then a photographer was like, I love how you do your makeup when we go and do shoots. Like, can I hire you to do makeup for a calendar for a casino? And I was like, oh my gosh, really? And he's like, yeah, I'll pay you. And I was like, oh my gosh, yes.
I thought I was supposed to pay you.
Right, exactly. It's always me paying to work. Yeah, and right. And so I got paid to do that. And then he immediately asked me to do another magazine, a bridal magazine. Mm-hmm. And I was treated incredibly rudely by another artist on that job. And it really broke my heart because I was just like, I'm finally feeling like a passion about something. And like everything, someone comes in and dumps their shit all over it. And then, you know, I'll rephrase that. Someone comes in and just like, cuss, okay, I was like, I don't know if it's like offensive to people.
But now you have to re-say it and cuss again so we have the full line.
But like, you know, it always feels like someone will always come along, even when I was at headquarters. And now here I am in this like beauty fashion industry and someone always has to come along and shit on it. And it's then my choice to say, do I fight back or do I just let them do it? And at the time, I was so enraged inside, but I had not learned how to vocalize anything because I was so used to just stuffing it back down, being the shiny, happy person, always be agreeable. You know, I never saw it as submissive. I just saw it as not causing a fuss. I didn't know what would happen if I created a fuss. That was, and still to this day, is very scary for me. When I use my voice, I don't know the workshopping of what will happen back at me. And if someone does come back at me, I'm just so all at that point, I'm so fragile emotionally and just the trauma side of me is just on full display. And so it's like, I don't know how to accept someone else coming back at me and not being happy because that place of me that's still unhealed and underdeveloped just wants to lash out and just go at someone. And I feel it. And I know where it comes from being harnessed back for so long. But it took me a long time to get my feet in the industry. And I mean, now I definitely know how to speak up on set because I know what happens and what comes back at me. But I have a podcast called We Speak Beauty. If anyone is ever interested, we have these episodes that we call Stories from Set. And it's just all of the horror stories that happen on photo shoots. And I tell a lot of my own. And when you think about my upbringing and you listen to these stories, you can hear that struggle of someone coming at me with authority, even though they're being a full-on jerk and have no right to do so. And yet my response is to just, you know, kind of submit to it and don't cause a fuss. Or for me, for the longest time, it was just simply shock. Mm-hmm. Why is this person telling me to get back on the floor where I belong? you know, when I'm using a fan on a model to move her hair around, and just yelled at me in the studio. And I'm like, what? Why can't you just ask me to get out of your shot? Like, why have we lost all ability to be kind and polite to people? It's all I've ever wanted in life, is for people to just be freaking nice to each other. And yet it seems to be, it fails to happen, especially in the fashion and the beauty industry. It's very cutthroat. But I decided to put myself on a big burner and go to New York City. Let's make it even better. Let's go to the big fashion capital of America. Yeah. So anyway, long story short, I connected with an artist. Her name is Lottie. If you guys are into makeup and hair stuff, go and follow her on Instagram. Her account is LottStar, and she is a star. She's like, she's my guiding light in this industry. And I've been her first assistant for fashion shows overseas, New York, Milan, Paris, London, for like 10 or 15 years now at this point. Yeah. And just my life is amazing. I love this career so much and try to navigate it to the best of my ability, but not as a broken bird.
Yeah. Well, and the fact that you can navigate it, like you can choose who you work with and what you do. And like you've really found your voice in incredible ways. And I think now probably recognize like the people who are the worst tend to be the people that are not the best. They're insecure. They're usually not as competent as others. Like, I actually interviewed, so I tinker with a film podcast. I've not put the effort into, I probably will at some point, but, I got to interview V. Neal, who's a makeup artist who's worked on basically every movie that's ever been made ever. And, talking to her, the interview was really cool, but the cool thing was I got to talk to her for like an hour on the phone before doing the interview. It was so weird, but it spoke to her personality where like she called me to like ask what I wanted from the interview and then ended up talking for like an hour, just sharing stories. But what I took away was just, it was so much of that personality of like, you know, so-and-so said this, you know, and she's like, oh, fuck them. I don't care about them. And there's this. But she was so kind and so giving of her time. And I'm like, you're the last person that should be giving me this time because I'm nobody. Like you're like an Oscar winning makeup artist who's like worked with everybody. But she was like so down to earth and chill. And I was like, that's the mark of confidence.
Yeah.
Like, and knowing that you are the best at what you do. And it's cool. Like whatever industry you're in, like I'm not in that world, but like working with people who are in entrepreneurship and that, like I've met the people that come in and blow up the way that fundamentalist pastors did. And it is super hard to deal with. Yeah. But then you can, like you said, you can navigate, you can stick up for yourself, and then you can never work with those people again.
Oh, exactly.
You're not locked in the way you used to be locked in with this stuff. And it's kind of fun to realize when someone blows up, like, oh, that's just a really insecure person. Like, they're really struggling to hold it all
together. You're so transparent, bro. Yeah, I'm like, you're just so transparent. And you think that you have these big walls up and you big, mean, bad photographer.
I'm tough.
And you're just like, whatever. I don't have time for you. That's what I say in my head. I'm like, I don't have time for you.
I talked to someone recently and he was, I forget who it was. But anyway, he basically says like the number one way to quickly lose all respect on your set is basically to blow up. He's like, the minute a director screams at anybody, like, he's lost everybody because it just make it, you lose all of your power in that moment because people go, oh, you don't know what you're doing. Like it immediately just shows like you're in a panic. But again, I think if you can reframe and go like, okay, now I know that, like, I'm not going to let it affect me the way that it has in the past. It's a cool, I don't know. I like laughing at people now. I find a lot of respect.
I mean, film sets are a different beast. I've only been done a few films, but I do find that the director is like the patriarch of the family, you know, of the entire crew. And they do, even for photography, like they set the tone for the entire room and the entire space. And I don't think that a lot of people realize that in walking in, you have such a beautiful potential to be a wonderfully guiding leader, to orchestrate everyone that comes together to have the most like fruitful outcome of a shoot. But yeah, these ones that just want to like taskmaster their way through it. It's just I always hate the images when I'm on jobs like that, because I can tell that I'm almost like I'm doing makeup under duress, you know, or I'm just like, just get it done and get me out of here. Where's my paycheck? See ya. you know, and I hate that feeling. I love when we can just have this like breath of air and everybody's in such a good mood and it's a creative space.
Yeah.
I get to do a creative thing for my job. No. That's my job, is to be a creative person. But I come from all this traumatized background. So I show up on time. I stay late. I am very meticulous and almost OCD to a point when I do certain things with makeup. And I love that about myself. Like, I've brought the things that were, you know, the pinnacles, if you will, of being an ATI kid. And I've made something more of it for myself and taken those weird assets that are very, I'm a very controlling person, you know, but it's because I know now it's not like, oh, I'm a controlling person in a mean and cruel way to others. I just want the best thing to be put forward on that photo and on that model. And so I'm very perfectionistic and very, very meticulous. And it used to drive me crazy that I was like that. But thankfully with therapy, she's like, this is an asset to you.
Yeah.
Like, this makes you the better artist that you are. So like, lean into it.
Yeah. It's a superpower if you're aware and know how to control it. It's right. A good thing.
And don't let it haunt you. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I know we're near the end. I have just two more questions. This you have built, and you brushed past it, but like, you've had an incredible career that I'm like, how the heck did I not know any of this? Where it's like, you're working with like Vogue and GQ and like a billion different brands. Everybody's heard of. You created a life that was so separate from, I mean, 23 years out of this really horrific environment, where your life now is not at all representative of that. No. And by design, you know, like, you ran from that as fast as possible. A whole nother podcast would be doing that with a husband who grew up in that as well. But
yeah, seriously,
I'm really curious, from that frame of reference, when Shiny Happy People rolls around, you know, and I know nobody asked you about Shiny Happy People, so I'll ask you one question about it. But when that rolled around, I just want to know, was there a part of you that was like, I don't want to talk about this. Like, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to go into this conversation. I'm past this. I'm removed from it. I'm good. Let's let it lie where it is. Or was it like, finally, I get to go center stage on this and really talk about it?
I had already been on TikTok telling my story in April of 2020 is when I started the TikTok that I have. So that was sort of my first time. If you go to my very first TikTok video, it's hysterical. She's so cute, that little Lindsay. I'm so out of breath. And I think I say something like, hi, I'm Lindsay, and I'm coming to you to tell you, like, this is almost like I'm in a confession booth or something. But I was just like, I was raised in a cult, and I couldn't believe I was saying it out loud. And I chose to make my username Cult Chronicles. And I was just like, I'm terrified, but this is really, I just have to do this. But in stepping out and trying to say something about it, I ended up discovering Chad Harris from the documentary and Heather and all of that before the documentary. So when the documentary was presented to me, I was like, heck yes, bring it on. And partly also because I was asked to be a part of the lawsuit, the original lawsuit against Bill Gothard. And I was in New York City at the time working on this career. I had not done any personal work. You know, I think when we talk about deconstructing and walking away from faith and everything, I was not doing that with an active intention. I was like, okay, that's over here. And now I'm going to go life. I'm going to go do life things. And I was struggling the whole way. When I say flopping like a carp, I'm not kidding. I mean, I was so out of oxygen, but I was still flopping around. And when that was presented to me, I was so terrified. Like, the PTSD that I didn't know I was experiencing, the panic, like, for weeks, I couldn't even focus on photo shoots or anything. I was walking around the city feeling claustrophobic everywhere. I hated my life. But, you know, I had two beautiful friends that wanted me to be involved, and we had some phone call conversations. And I finally, like, at the end of one of them, I was like, I will help you. In because she decided to go ahead with it. And I was like, I will help support you in if you need, you know what I mean, like testimony from me, corroborating stories, but I can't do this. Like, I need to cut the call short. I'm so sorry. And that was it. And I heard nothing back from people. And I just had to watch online like everybody else did to see what was going on. So I always had like a bit of guilt with that. And yet when I would line it up with, do I regret it? Do I regret not doing the lawsuit? The answer was always no. I don't regret it. Do I feel bad that I kind of, in my mind at the time, that I left them out in the cold, you know, that I didn't come in and support them at the time? And so when the opportunity with Shiny Happy People came along, I was like, this is my chance. This is finally my chance to be able to say something when before I was too scared to do anything. And it was a weird like retribution for myself too, that I'm like, I will say something. I will do something of impact, because IBLP should not be allowed to exist any longer. And as many dings as we can put into that, that's, I just want it to end. So, you know, it's weird with the deconstruction, like I said, because I didn't feel like that's what I was doing. And I wasn't really aware of all of that until the pandemic hit. And then I started reading my journals, and I hadn't seen them in 23 years. And it was so upsetting. I called one of my friends hyperventilating. And I was just like, I don't know what to do with all of this. Like I was too terrified still. 20 years out of this, I was terrified to go to a therapist. I had like it was still that indoctrinating, like the like weird, I don't even know what's indoctrinating. It was conditioning. Like I had an irrational conditioned feeling that therapy would not help me. And he really had to very gently but sternly push me into going to therapy. And I started doing EMDR therapy, which blew my socks off. And I know it seems very intimidating to a lot of people, but if you have a lot of PTSD and CPTSD from a lot of types of trauma, not just religious trauma, sexual trauma, abuse, I'm telling you, it will change your life. You have to very bravely and boldly step into it, but you've already lived those bad experiences. Now you're redefining them through EMDR. And it really, that was the catalyst for me to even be prepared for Shiny Happy People.
I know, like, obviously therapy, you've mentioned on many shows, like being helpful for you. You mentioned you have a necklace that you wear.
I do.
It's the Camuso.
Here it is.
The right.
Yeah. Yep, the Camuso necklace, the shift.
Yeah, which is pretty cool. Basically helps with breathing and it's
regulating your breath.
Yeah, there's a lot of cool, neat resources like that. And I guess now kind of my final question is, like you said, the movement is in its dying stages. It's right. Gasping its
twilight last years.
Breath of air. You know, we laugh saying that, it's going down very quickly. Mm-hmm. And like you said, there's someone trying to put together, an anti Shiny Happy People documentary series, which this interview will probably get more views than all of their content put together. so it just seems like the fight back is very minimal at this point.
Yeah.
What's your goal with your content moving forward? Because it seems like the shift from the outside looking in, both at the IBLP world and the IFB world, which are so crossed over, it feels like we're talking about the same things in many ways. It seems like the shift in focus is not so much taking down the organization, because it seems like that work is being done actively. It has nowhere else to go. What's the shift in focus now in terms of reaching out to people who've been through it, in terms of like next steps in talking about it? Because I think we still need to talk about it. Even if it completely shut its doors tomorrow, there's value in it. What do you think your goal is kind of in your advocacy and activism moving forward?
Another wonderful question. I think I've triggered my husband a few times because I've been purchasing material. And he's like, why in the world do you have this in the house? I'm just like, because I'm going to literally go through every character quality. Like for me, I want people to understand how, just like to me, the umbrella diagram in the documentary was a real aha moment for people that weren't even raised in fundamentalism, you know, or IFB or IBLP, ATI, whatever. Where they're like, oh my God, that was at my church, or my mom showed that to me and I remember that. And I'm like, of course, yeah, because it props up authority. and what parent doesn't want you to listen and obey everything they say? And I think that when we have a platform like that and we provide that insight, we also need to be there for kind of like the trauma that also reveals for everyone else. And I know that I'm not responsible for everybody on this planet, but I feel like I have done a lot of the work now. And so I want to be there for people when they find these aha moments with fundamentalism. And at least it's someone that they can go to and ask a question. And I want to keep unveiling more, which is like, don't want to traumatize everybody. However, like Bill Gothard had 49 character qualities. And this is one of the things that I want to start talking about, because these character quality definitions are words you can find in the dictionary: obedience, attentiveness, alertness, discretion, compassion, you know, these types of things. But the definitions are not correct. The intention of them is not correct. And in some of my deconstructing, and my beautiful armchair therapist, Daniel Klingler, he and I have spent hours and hours and hours where he would use a word with me. My biggest trigger word is forgiveness. And he would say, you know, well, what do you feel like when someone tells you to forgive? And I would say, like, absolutely not. It's not their right to force me or demand me or request that I forgive them. That is only for myself. And he's like, where is this coming from, though? And we looked up the definition that Bill, because that's the definition I have. I don't have dictionary definitions to these types of words. I was so indoctrinated at a young age that this is what forgiveness is, something that you must do for others in order for you to heal. But it's a doing for others so that others, and I told him my definition is that so others get to go free. Not so that I find freedom, but so that other people get to go free and go do those bad things again. And so then I have no trust. And how is that a godly perspective of forgiveness? Like, that's not how that works. So I want to be able to sort of like, look, I'm not a scholar. I'm just a freaking homeschool kid. But I want to be able to unveil those types of things and share that with people, because I know that those are some ahas that we don't realize we're carrying with us. So that's more my advocacy, but also therapy. And I think that there needs to be more conversation about that, because that mental health aspect with all of the CPTSD and stuff that we have gone through, we're not healing our bodies, and our bodies need to learn to not be so hyperactive. And the fight, flight, freeze, and fawn experience, I love when I realize that I am disassociating in an appropriate moment. And I love when I realize that my fight or flight shows up when it's now supposed to. And that feels so healing to me. And yet a lot of us are still going to be in that space where we're afraid to use our voice because we don't know what happens when the other person uses theirs. And those are those type of call and responses that I feel like I want to be able to help people understand and shed light on, and hopefully just continue to knock down even Christian nationalism and all of this other just like hyper mania that's going on right now surrounding Christian religious beliefs.
I'm excited to keep seeing this progression. And like you said, there's a lot of different things that all, it almost feels like you're cutting the head off something and then there's two more heads grow back. Like there's always something that's like connected in some way. So I'm excited to see your takes on all of those moving forward. But for anybody listening, go check out Shiny Happy People. If you haven't gotten kind of the deep dive, I can't even say deep dive, the basic introduction to this,
right?
There's so much more to go. And just through your content, through all the other people in the series have content.
Everybody.
Incredible. Chad Harris, like there's a lot of great perspectives there. So you can go down this rabbit hole for a good minute, but thank you for sharing so much. Thank you for giving me so much more time than I asked you for initially. I really appreciate the conversation.
I just appreciate you too. I've admired the work that you've been doing for years, and I was so giddy to be able to come onto your podcast. So thank you for from one documentary person to another. Thank you for letting me share a space with you.
Thank you for listening to the Preacher Boys podcast. If you appreciated the content on the show, please leave a review on iTunes and don't forget to connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc.